Did you know that there's a scientifically proven correlation between the amount of testosterone in an organism and how much that organism tends to take risks and how much that organism tends to think about sex? There's a woman from actually several women that have been on hormonal therapies that had to wear testosterone patches. One woman, a friend of mine in California, she said, "I can't stop thinking about sex. Is this what guys have to deal with?" Well, the answer is yes. But it's not just guys. See, women also have testosterone. In fact, this other woman, I didn't know her personally, but I read about it. She said she had no sex drive for years. She got married. It was recording a real problem. She and her husband went to a therapist. The therapist recommended testosterone patches. And she said she had to go off them after a month because she would walk down the street and she would mentally undress everybody. She didn't know how to turn it off. And it was simply having more testosterone in her veins. That's one of the things that testosterone does. But see, women also have testosterone. Some women have a lot more than others. My daughter is life's ever-present reminder to me that there's a wisdom larger than my ego at work. Because not only, I was a peace activist for most of my adult life, not only is my daughter a sergeant in the Marine Corps, my daughter is one of the first women in U.S. history to be on the all-Marine wrestling team. My baby girl wrestles for the Marine Corps, and she kicks butt. And her pacifist daddy is so damn proud of her. Although she's in Iraq right now, so I'm a little concerned. But anyway, my point is this, that men and women have a certain base level of testosterone. But if you get promoted at work, or if anywhere where there's a rise in status, where people are looking up to you, where they weren't looking up to you before, your testosterone levels, men and women, will rise, and in some cases will shoot up. But if you don't know this, see, what you will always do, what the monkey mind has to do, is the monkey mind will always interpret. The monkey mind will always make meaning. So let's say you've got a great relationship with your spouse, okay? There's no temptation. It's easier for you to be in integrity. And then you get promoted at work. Or you get voted into office. And I'm not even talking about the president of New York, or Congress, I mean, the governor of New York, or president of the United States. I'm talking about, you know, your school board. I was going to say church council president, but that's probably not a high status position. But, you know, in any way where there's a rise in status, okay, where you're the manager of your store or whatever, your testosterone levels will rise. Now, let's say you interpret this, okay, all of a sudden you got sex on the brain, right? And let's say you interpret this as though maybe something's wrong with your relationship to your spouse. After all, why would you be having thoughts about this other person? Or fantasies about this other person? Or dreaming about this other person? Or if you're a real spiritual type and you pray about it and you interpret that this is God's will that you connect with Sarah Jane. Or if you interpret this as though you're simply fundamentally evil or sinful or flawed. Or if you're a Christian and you interpret that the reason you have these immoral thoughts is because your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother ate an apple because she was tempted by a snake in a garden. You're not going to know how to stay in impeccable, what I call Christ-like integrity, which is our only way to salvation. It's the only way to have freedom around our unchosen nature, is deep ecological integrity, deep evolutionary integrity. And however you interpret the stories of Jesus the Christ in the New Testament, right, whether you interpret those stories as completely historically factual in every detail, total day language, or if you interpret them as completely fiction, complete night language, it's saying symbolic truth, but Jesus never lived, or anything in between, it doesn't matter. If you take a straightforward reading of those stories, the figure of Jesus the Christ in those stories is the embodiment, the incarnation of divine humility, authenticity, responsibility, and service. Humility or trust or faith, authenticity, responsibility, and serving God's will, serving a larger purpose. And those four together, I call the DNA of deep integrity, the DNA of evolutionary integrity. And it is our only way to have freedom and salvation around this part of our nature, and it's also the only way that our species is going to move into a just, healthy, sustainable, and life-giving future. And I don't find this as a coincidence. Let me tell you a true story. This only happened a few months ago. I preached on this on a Sunday morning in Florida, maybe 4 months ago. And there was this gentleman, he was probably 70, I'm guessing he was 70 years old, he didn't tell me how old he was, but somewhere around 70. And he came up to me after the church service, and he was just ecstatic. He was vibrating. He said, "I've got to tell you something. I have never told another living being this." And he was saying this loud enough that some of his congregational friends could hear it. And I was like, it felt a little awkward. But he said, in 1973, I became vice president of my corporation. He said, I had all this responsibility, all this leadership. He said, I had no idea that my libido would just shoot through the roof. He said, I had been faithful to my wife. I had been married for 12 years. I had never betrayed my wife's trust. Within 6 months of my promotion, I had 5 affairs. None of them knew about each other. My wife didn't know about any of them. It ultimately cost me my marriage. It cost me my job. And I've been living with the guilt and the shame of this for 35 years, or however many years ago. He said, your sermon helped me not only understand what was going on, but he says, now I feel like I can let go of the guilt and the shame so I can start cleaning up this stuff. And he did. Between Sunday morning and Tuesday night, which is when I did the follow-up workshop, he called his ex-wife. He started calling these other women. He started apologizing for being such a deceptive, lying sack, and started coming back into integrity. And guess what? Surprise, surprise. A depression that he had for the last 12 or 15 years, I forget, lifted. Just by coming back to Christ, to use that kind of night language, coming back into integrity.
This is actually a picture of a friend of mine. This is his daughter. They went to a zoo, and there's a plate glass between these two. Look at the is this extraordinary? I want to share another story. This is a true story. My wife's niece, we call the parable of the pickle jar. My wife's niece, Halsey Barlow, grew up in a very, very conservative Catholic family. Her mother and father listened to Rush Limbaugh every day. Her mother's totally anti-evolution. And Halsey went to nursing school. And her first semester of nursing school, she had an ecology professor. It wasn't even an evolution class, it was an ecology class. And he was a fanatic about evolution. And so they did a 6-week component on evolution. And she had to write a paper on Madagascan lemurs. That's what these are. And she sent us this, she had this conversion to evolution. She was like, she got it. She was like, she saw how beautiful evolution was. Well, she sent us this email. We call it the parable of the pickle jar. Oh, actually, first she read Robert Wright's award-winning book, The Moral Animal, Why We Are the Way That We Are, The New Science of Evolutionary Psychology. My wife, Connie, says she wishes every 13-year-old girl in the world would read this book, because then they would understand why boys are different. And then she sent us this email. She said, I now put everything into an evolutionary context. It's almost become a reaction, and when I encounter a situation, I think, okay, why am I feeling this way? How and why would my 780th great-grandmother react to this? It doesn't even have to be anything significant. For instance, if I see one of my roommates snacking on my jar of pickles, I get this feeling in my stomach like, hey, back off, those are mine. I want to be laid back and not care, but my instincts are so darn uptight. But knowing that I'm a selfish, status-eating hornball only motivates me to do things and say, I don't need my evolutionary roots, even though I really do love them. I absolutely love how imperfect and clumsy we are as humans. I mean, almost any situation can be laughed off if we only step back and take a look at why we feel the way that we do. I love it. I wouldn't want it any other way. Isn't this amazing for an 18-year-old? I know some 60-year-olds that don't have this level of witness. It's just amazing. We also have puppets. We have, like, you know, lizard legacy puppets. We do programs with kids. And we did a program with grade school kids, the first graders, second graders. And this one kid came home from school about 2 weeks later, and his mother told us the story. She sent us an email. He said he came home from school, and he said that Mommy, we had a fire drill. Now, I need to capture it. You know that part of your brain, the lizard legacy, your reptilian brain? You know when you feel stressed out and you just find yourself going over to the refrigerator and opening up the freezer, taking out the ice cream, and you think to yourself, no bowl needed, right? Okay? That's the part of our brain. It's the part of it when we get stressed out that says, food. Right? That's the lizard legacy, right? And the monkey mind is always trying to figure things out, right, and getting worried. Well, this kid comes home from school, says to his mom, we had a fire drill. And the mother said, really? Well, tell me about it. And he said, I was so scared the bells were clanging. And on my way out, I said to myself, monkey body, calm down. Lizard legacy, you're not hungry. Is that amazing for a first grader?
Evolutionary psychology encourages compassion.
compassion and cooperation because it explores what we all have in common, human universals. In fact, there was a neurobiologist that came to us in New Orleans about 3 months ago, and she said, you know, I've been studying neurobiology, and the more I learn about evolutionary psychology and evolutionary brain science, the more compassion that I have for myself and others. She said, isn't it amazing and somewhat ironic that science is giving us access to this traditional spiritual virtue? I mentioned that in evolutionary psychology, there's a thing called mismatch theory, that our instincts are not matched for the world that we, in fact, live in. Right? Our instincts are, there's a mismatch. What I mean by this is that you would not expect a snake or a cow or a wolf or a bear or an elephant to go counter to its instincts very easily. I mean, you know, you wouldn't expect a bear to go counter to its instincts very easily. It's pretty tough for an animal to go counter to its instincts. Yet we're expected to go counter our instincts every day. I mean, as a high test, confession time, as a high testosterone alpha male type, my instincts are to mate if it moves. And yet if I act on my instincts, my marriage goes down the tubes, my mission goes down the tubes, my ministry falls apart, my life is in shambles if I simply act on my instincts. So the question is, how do we support each other in being in integrity, being in Christ, so that our instincts serve God's will, serves our higher purpose? And that's where this perspective offers a tremendous amount. This is where young people are finding. In fact, the first time that I ever preached on this stuff on a Sunday morning, all the teenagers showed up for my evening workshop. That never happens. I love this one. The universe becomes self-conscious. Eat, survive, reproduce. Eat, survive, reproduce. Eat, survive, reproduce. Eat, survive, reproduce. What's it all about? And we wonder why we occasionally struggle with issues related to food, safety, and sex. I mean, come on. And see, here's the interesting thing. Women who are in the presence of high-status males, their testosterone levels will rise. And again, this makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. For millions of years, if you were a woman, for millions of years, who were the men that were likely going to be able to care for you and your children? The high-status men, the high-status males. So it's not a surprise. This all makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. And what I'm suggesting, I'm not going into the details tonight, right? On two of my DVDs, I take a look at the major core Christian concepts. Sin and salvation, the kingdom of God, heaven and hell, Jesus as the way, the truth, and the life. And I show how these can all be understood in a larger, more meaningful, more this world realistic way from this evolutionary perspective. Interpret the insights of evolutionary psychology and evolutionary brain science religiously. Revitalize our appreciation of doctrines such as the fall and original sin. Now we can comprehend in a realistic way why it is that we and our loved ones struggle with unwanted habits and why our most important relationships can be so challenging. If you compress the whole history of the universe into 100 years, when did God create us? When did we emerge out of the body of life? Anybody know? Like if you compress the whole history of the universe into 100 years, you know what humans show up? Yeah, exactly. The last week, on December 25th of the 99th year, interesting enough, Christmas Day, of the 99th year, is when Homo erectus, I mean actually Homo habilis, walking upright using stone tools. On December 29th of the 99th year, we domesticated fire. And December 31st of the 99th year, the last day of a 100-year process is when we started using symbolic words, that is, using language to speak. Now think about it. If we show up on the last day of a 100-year process, to me, it indicates at least the possibility that the whole thing wasn't meant for us. I mean, maybe the whole thing was meant for God, for the whole. And our purpose is to, you know, in fact, let me talk about what's the role of the human? What's God's will for humanity? Not just for us as individuals, but what's our purpose? What's our role in the evolutionary story? Well, to talk about it in terms of night language, what do the traditional Christian scriptures and our creeds, like for example, well, actually these are our creeds, but the Baltimore Catechism, the Westminster Catechism, I'm assuming some of you grew up Catholic, or maybe Catholic now.
Do you know what the Baltimore Catechism and the Westminster Catechism say is the chief end of man, that is the purpose of humanity? Exactly, yeah. John Calvin said the same thing, basically. That our purpose is to know, love, and serve God, to glorify God and enjoy God forever. Now, could that be a religious way of saying the same things that science is now saying is the role of our species? I mean, not just one small subset of humanity, but the role of our species is to glorify God, that is to celebrate the whole in self-conscious reflection. To fully, to know, love, and serve God. See, the idea that we could praise God and trash the environment or treat others in an unjust way is being out of touch with reality. We cannot, well, let me say it in a positive way. When we love others, when we work for justice and peace and sustainability, when we care for our neighbor as ourselves, when we work to heal injustices in the world, we are, in fact, in the doing of those, praising God, serving a larger whole. The two are interrelated. And so from an evolutionary perspective, if we show up on the last day of a 100-year process, given how recently humans showed up, right? Earth showed up at the age of 71 or 72 on this 100-year process. So this is not so much a picture of human beings looking at the Earth. I mean, that's what I'm going to talk about. But from a deep time perspective, a more accurate way of talking about this picture is this is one of the first times that Earth became complex enough that a piece of itself could get off of itself and look back at itself. This is Earth looking in the mirror. In fact, one of my favorite quotes from Joanna Macy, she's one of my sheroes. She says, "This shift, the shift from seeing ourselves as separate creatures that walk around on Earth in a universe, to seeing ourselves as a mode of being of Earth, an expression of the universe," she says, "this shift is essential to our survival." It's a huge claim she's making. "Because it can serve in lieu of morality, and because moralizing is so ineffective." She says, "Sermons seldom hinder us from pursuing our self-interest." I mean, as preachers, we know that we can preach till we're blue in the face, and you're going to do what's in your own perceived self-interest, regardless of whatever we preach. So Joanna Macy says, what we need is to be a little more enlightened about what our self-interest is. For example, it would never occur to me to say to you, "Don't cut off your leg." "No, really, don't cut off your leg." Because your leg's a part of you, and you know it. Well, so are the trees in the Amazon basin. There are external lungs. And that's what we're waking up to, Joanna Macy says, is that we are our world. And what we do to our world, we do to ourselves, our larger body. It matters what we think about evolution. Trying to understand reality without an evolutionary worldview is like trying to understand infection without microscopes or the structure of the universe without telescopes. It's not merely difficult, it's impossible. Until we recognize billions of years, not just thousands of years, of grace and guidance, we will remain stuck with abstract and trivial concepts of God, morally confusing and divisive notions of Scripture, and unnatural and competitive understandings of religion. If I was arguing in a court of law that God has become a trivialized concept in the West, the first person I would call to the stand would be Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is one of the world's best-known scientists, but he just wrote a book called The God Delusion. Now think about it. Would anybody ever write a book, or would anybody buy a book called The Life Delusion? The Universe Delusion? No. The reason is because life and the universe are not trivial concepts. They're undeniably real. God is no longer understood as undeniably real in the West. God is an idea, a hypothesis. Do you believe in the supreme being up there, out there, that created the universe, or do you not? That's a trivial God. See, from the sacred evolutionary perspective, God is beyond belief or disbelief. God is that one and only creative reality, that whether we call that reality or not a God, is infused in every drop of experience. There's no place that God stops and something else starts. And this is something that the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim traditions have always said, is this immanence and omnipresence of God. And yet, for the last 700 years, we've lost that. And the reason is because we, for the last 700 years, had a mechanistic understanding of the universe. That is, we thought nature was like a complex clock. See, 10,000 years ago, and most, now, we need to be humble about what was happening 10,000 years ago, but most scientists would say that 10,000 years ago, in most places in the world, we had feminine images for ultimacy. The great goddess, the Earth Mother. Because it made sense. I mean, out of women, our species continued. And we can see out of the female of all other species, they continue. So whatever brought everything into existence must be like a woman. Well, about 5,000 years ago, two technologies come into being that begin shifting the metaphors. One of them is the technology of the plow. Plows take male upper body strength. So men begin to step in and become the primary food providers. Roughly at the same time that writing develops. And writing promotes a sequential, linear, abstract, one could even say patriarchal way of thinking. In fact, there was a best-selling book, I'm sure some of you saw it, for 2 years. It was called The Alphabet Versus the Gods, written by Leonard Shaines, a brain surgeon in California, who talked about, among other things, that when writing and the plow come into a culture, typically very quickly, in less than 1,000 years, the major metaphors for ultimacy shift from feminine to masculine, meaning the gods, or I mean the goddesses are replaced by the gods. Now, ultimacy is described as father, lord, king, warrior, these strong dominant male images. But again, it's the whole of reality that's being referred to. It's not a surprise that we find ultimate reality, God, being referred to as king, not long after we find the first kings in human existence. I mean, this makes sense. I mean, remember before when I talked about that when we reflected on different planets, different animals, different terrain, different climate, we would use different metaphors to describe the nature of ultimacy? I mean, let's say we over here had never experienced a sheep. Lamb of God would be part of our tradition. If we over here had never experienced the political reality of king, the kingdom of God would be a totally foreign concept. We tell stories of Lotus blossoms, you know, whatever's a part of our experience. So all religions make sense given the different bioregions and cultures in which they emerge. It doesn't mean they all make sense if you interpret their core doctrines as true in day language, but they all make profound sense if you interpret their core doctrines as saying something cosmologically true, that is true in night language. What would you do if somebody came up to you and said, do you believe in life? Excuse me, do you believe in the universe? Do you believe in water? Dave, do you believe in water? Right? It's absurd, right? It doesn't matter whether we believe in water or not. We're 50-70% water. We wouldn't exist without water. Right? It doesn't matter whether we believe in life or not. Now, what you say about life, now that's believable or not. Somebody can say, life is so kind and wonderful. Somebody says, life sucks, it's terrible. Well, that's believable or not, depending upon your experience and your worldview. But the fact of life just is. As I said, it doesn't matter whether we believe in reality or not. Reality is something that we're all dealing with all the time. In fact, one of my favorite quotes from Philip K. Dick, he's a science writer, or a science fiction writer, he says, reality is that which when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. And that's what I'm pointing to, undeniably real God. God didn't stop revealing truth right at the human well-being back when people believed the world was flat and religious insights were reported on the animal skins. God is still communicating faithfully today, publicly, through the worldwide self-correcting scientific enterprise. Facts are God's native tongue. I mean, when we get the distinction between public and private revelation, when we get that facts are God's native tongue, I mean, how did God guide bacteria to create multicellularity? Through words? No. Through feelings, circumstances, and relationships. And that's how God guides us, the facts. I mean, okay, this may be a little risky to say in this context, but we'll say it anyway. Who of us would let a first century dentist fill our children's teeth? Yet so many of us, like first century theologians, fill our children's minds every day. It's because we haven't had these kind of distinctions. I'm not putting down the scriptures. Please hear me. I'm holding them in a larger sacred context that God is revealing to us today. I mean, where our species needs to go to first and foremost to learn how to go into a healthy future, how to serve God into the future, is not first and foremost text written 2,000-3,000 years ago. Where we need to go to first and foremost is what God is revealing to the entire range of sciences today. Until we see the entire history of the universe of Scripture and create laws and incentives that align the self-interest of individuals, corporations, and nations with the well-being of the body and life as a whole, we will continue to toxify the air, water, and soil, driving other species to extinction, and be hounded by religious, political, social, and
economic crisis. I can't even begin to tell you how important this is. And we will never learn this from our scriptures, our written scriptures. We can only learn this from the scriptures of the universe. For example, here is a picture, a visual image of greater complexity, greater interdependence, and greater cooperation at larger and wider scale. And as I said before, the Apostle Paul and Moses and John Calvin and Martin Luther could not have known this. This took telescopes, microscopes, and computers for us to understand greater complexity, greater interdependence, and greater cooperation at larger and wider scale. And how this happened, how this level of complexity happened, how this level of complexity happened, and so on. And on two of my DVDs, I spent about an hour on this, but I'm just going to touch on it at this moment, is that each level has to figure out how to align the self-interest of the parts with the well-being of the whole that the parts are part of. So if the parts do well to the whole, they benefit. And if the parts harm the whole, there's some cost or disadvantage to the parts. That's the primary thing that drives complexity in evolution at each level. And so we will only become sustainable as a species if we create a system. And this doesn't mean global government. What it means is where we govern ourselves so that individuals, corporations, and nations that serve the common good benefit. And the more good they do, the more they benefit. So they're incentivized to do as much good as possible. And individuals, corporations, and nation states that disregard or harm the common good are taxed or penalized, or there's moral strictures, so that it's in their self-interest to do the right, just, ecological thing, and it's also in their self-interest not to do the unjust, unecological thing. That's the primary thing that drives complexity and evolution, and we will never achieve sustainability if we don't do that. In an election year, we cannot trust our future to anyone who believes the world is but a few thousand years old and who interprets ancient apocalyptic writings as revealing God's perfect will. With global warming and global warring on the horizon, the time has come for down-to-earth leaders with heavenly aspirations that include everyone, everywhere. Until we grasp that death plays a vital and necessary role in an evolving cosmos, medical technologies will continue to prolong physical and emotional suffering. Medical choices will continue to provoke family discord, and the medical industry will continue to underwrite the widening gap between the rich and the poor. This is another place where we see the realizing of death and resurrection, what our Christian tradition points to so compellingly. But this is true not merely of something that happened to one God-man 2,000 years ago. It's pointing to something that's fundamentally true about the nature of the entire universe. In fact, Connie, my wife, does a whole program called Death Through Deep Time Eyes. It's on this DVD here. I think it's her best program. And what she does is she takes a look at the major sciences, paleontology, evolutionary biology, embryology, cell biology, and ecology, astronomy and astrophysics, geology and geography and math, and shows some of the major scientific discoveries in each of these areas that have helped us come to an understanding that there's not only nothing wrong with death, there's something profoundly right with death from God's perspective. You can't have a universe like ours without it. If it weren't for the death of stars, there could be no planets, there could be no life. If it weren't for the death of plants and animals, there could be no food. Once we circumnavigated the globe, that's once we had empirical proof that the world was finite, not infinite. You combine a finite world with an understanding of population, and you realize that if you want a world of children, you have to have the death of elders. Because if all you got is birth with no death, very quickly, you're wall-to-wall people, wall-to-wall skunks, wall-to-wall bacteria, 60 feet deep. Doesn't take long. So Connie spends an hour and 15 minutes on this, and we're going to now sum up in 3 minutes, actually less than 3 minutes, what she does in an hour and 15 minutes. So I need help here. Men in white, women in yellow. Men, without the death of stars, come on, man, let me help. Without the death of stars, there would be no planets and no life. Without the death of elders, there would be no room for children.
Without the death of fetal cells, we would all disappear.
Without the death of plants and animals, there would be no food.
Without the death of old ways of thinking, there would be no room for the new.
Without death, there would be no answer.
Without death, time would not be precious.
What then are the gifts of death?
The gifts of death are Mars and Mercury, Saturn and Earth.
The gifts of death are the atoms, the stars, and our bodies.
The gifts of death are the splendors of shape and form and color. The gifts of death are food, the sustenance of life.
The gifts of death are seeing, hearing, feeling, deeply feeling.
The gifts of death are the urgency to act, the desire to fully be and become.
The gifts of death are joy and sorrow, laughter and tears.
The gifts of death are lives that are fully and exuberantly lived, then graciously and gratefully given up for now and forevermore. Amen. And whether we use day or night language to speak about it, death is natural and generative at all levels of reality. Death is no less sacred than life. Or, to use a traditional Christian way of speaking about it, Good Fridays are consistently followed by Easter Sundays. Until churches in America preach evolution enthusiastically, sacredly, in ways that expand and enrich faith, the battle over the teaching of evolutionary science in public schools will never end. And this isn't something that's just a pipe dream here. There's 11,000, actually almost 12,000 now, clergy that have signed the clergy letter list. It's a Christian clergy that have signed a letter stating that they see no conflict between mainstream understanding of evolution and their faith. That will grow considerably soon. These are not the end times for humanity. They are just the beginning. We know this from the fossil record and from careful observation of the cosmos. Studying evolution is like following cosmic breadcrumbs home. Dinosaur bones and prehistoric artifacts, Hubble space photos and DNA are here to teach us faith, not test. And then finally, until we learn to see through sacred deep time eyes, atheists and fundamentalists will continue to blame each other for the world's ills, liberals and conservatives will keep trashing one another, and collectively, we will fail to see that enormous global challenges are divine evolutionary drivers guiding us to greatness.
Are you saying the answer to water problems, the only answer to water problems, is everyone appropriates the total scientific view of the world that you have appropriated, and that a large proportion of 6 billion people on the world have not, no, and a large proportion of the 9 billion people who will be on the world starving in X number of years ahead will not have?
No, I'm definitely not saying that. I'm not even saying anything close to that. What I'm suggesting is that as just a small fraction of leadership has an evolutionary understanding, we can create a system that aligns the self-interest of the parts with the world being whole. That is, in fact, something that's underway. There are heads of multi-billion dollar corporations that get this. There are major politicians in the world that get this.
Major so it doesn't get what?
They, this understanding that evolution, that we, as we learn,
names of some of these
Bill Clinton and Al Gore, for example. Bill Clinton and Al Gore, for example. I know this. I don't want to fight with anybody. I'm suggesting that no, everybody doesn't need to convert to an evolutionary worldview. I'm never claiming that. Well, I apologize that it sounded like that, but what I am saying, what I tried to say at the start, is that if you are coming from a non-evolutionary perspective, that's fine. I'm trying to simply share one way. I mean, one of the reasons I think my book has been endorsed by 5 Nobel Prize winners and like 120 other theologians and scientists and rabbis and ministers across the spectrum is because this perspective is offering a hopeful perspective that's bridging the science and religion gap. But it doesn't work for everybody. Perhaps it doesn't work for you. Like, but
well,
it,
I was taught to accept evolution 60 years ago.
I don't understand your
but
claim.
I don't then. Necessarily have the full grasp of it, but I...
Right, but you don't need...
...subjects and practicalities of life.
Sure, you don't need it. Nor do the starving...
But it sounded like if people don't have that, absorb this reality, this view of it, the reality of reality, they'll live in the old world, they might as well be in the flat world, they'll operate as if they were in the pre-scientific world, and we're moving towards all destroying one another.
Well,
better weapons now than ever before.
Right.
World War I, 12 million, World War II, 50 million, and we were very close to
because I'm trying to do everything that I can in my lifetime to make a difference, but you will be called to make a difference in different ways. But I want to be just clear, because it's raising an important issue. I am not saying that converting everybody to this worldview is our way into the future. I'm just not saying that. And I apologize if it's sounding like that, but I'm really trying not to say that at all. No matter what our attempts to inform, it is our ability to inspire that will turn the tides. This is what I'm trying to do, is simply offer a way beyond the current impasse of science versus religion, to say that sciences can enrich and strengthen and deepen all people's religious faith, whatever their religion happens to be. Quote, and then I'll talk a little bit about some books and tapes, and then I'll stick around and answer questions one-on-one with people all night long until they get me out of here. Tell me a creation story more wondrous than that of a living cell forged from the residue of an exploded star. Tell me a story of transformation more magical than that of a fish falling out onto land and becoming amphibian, or that of a reptile taken into the air and becoming bird, or that of a mammal slipping back into the sea and becoming whale. Surely, this science-based culture of all cultures can find meaning and cause for celebration in its very own cosmic creation story. I found this quote on a national membership magazine, and it was written by someone I had never met, and I decided I was going to track her down and marry her because I was so impressed with this quote. If you want to explore this kind of a sacred way of thinking about evolution more deeply, and especially if you want to share this perspective with others for free, what we most recommend are our DVDs. Each of these is 4 hours of our best programs, and we give you the rights to make copies. We have the covers up on the website. So if you have a color printer, you can print off these. But, you know, you can go to Kinko's or Office Depot or Staples, or, you know, you can make reproductions, exact replicas, very, very inexpensively. And this does not mean put them in a fire. It means make copies. This one is a companion DVD to my book. This was the first Nobel Prize winner that wrote an endorsement. At last, someone who understands that all reality is sacred and science is our method of comprehending it. I was in tears when I got his email. But I cover these topics. Some of these I touched on tonight. I cover them in much more depth on this 2 hours of this DVD. And especially how this perspective is transforming people's lives and relationships. Now, the other 2 hours on this DVD set, I did with the high school girls at a Catholic Girls Academy. And this is by far the best program that I have for evangelicals. So if you are an evangelical, or if you have any evangelicals in your life, this is by far the best bridge that I have. Because I asked that these high school girls, I let their questions guide my entire presentation. And so this is all about, even if you're not a Christian, you'll find virtually everything on this meaningful, but it's specifically a bridge to traditional Christianity. All of that is on this 4-hour DVD set here. Now this one is mostly Connie. Y'all have gotten a big dose of me, you didn't get any of Connie. This is 4 hours, but 3 hours and 10 minutes of it is my wife. These are my 2 most popular sermons that I do in liberal religious contexts. And then Connie does a 45-minute program called Coming Home to North America. It's how to become native to this continent. See, this is what North America looked like 65 million years ago. It was not a continent of North America as such. There was Western North America that was hooked over to Asia. There was Eastern North America that was hooked over to Europe. And a shallow seaway, the Bear Paw Seaway, right through the middle. All this is underwater. South America is completely isolated from anywhere else in the world. All this is underwater. So this is the asteroid that knocked out the dinosaurs. And it was only when the Colorado Rockies began rising 62 million years ago that dried up the Bear Paw Seaway. In fact, it was only 3 million years ago. South America was isolated for 90 million years, and only 3 million years ago did this hook up. And all the big mammals from North America went south and just devastated, just demolished, just overpowered, wiped out all the mammals, all the big mammals of South America. The idea that everything else lives in harmony and only we humans do damage is totally false from an evolutionary perspective. Connie tells the story of which animals came over from Asia 55 million years ago, 70 million years ago, 5 million years ago. These are the natives to North America. Did you know that camels are native to North America? If anything is native to North America, camels are. Here they were for 55 million years. The pronghorn antelope, which is just a little bit further west from here, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, right? The pronghorn can run 65 miles an hour. But the fastest predator in North America is the wolf. The wolf can only run 40 miles an hour. What's a pronghorn running from? Well, it's running from its partner of 15 million years, the American cheetah. It's the only genus of cat native to North America. And Connie tells this story brilliantly. She talks about, we are made of stardust. She teaches Montessori teachers how to teach kids of all ages. This is one of the programs that I think would be really useful. The new periodic table of elements, which kinds of stars create which kinds of atoms. Our sun is hydrogen becoming helium. Inside red giant stars, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen form. And then inside blue-white stars that have a supernova explosion, all these other elements are formed in the periodic table of elements. And as I said, I think this is kind of his best program of all, definitely worth the price of this DVD. Whatever your views about what happens after death, just understanding the material fact of death will build trust, will build faith, I promise. In fact, everything that we sell, if you're not 100% satisfied, just send me an email, michael@thegreatstory.org. We'll refund your money. We've made this promise for 6 years, three times if I ever had to return anything. And this is definitely worth the price of this DVD, this death program. So this is mostly Connie. The main program that I delivered for almost 3 years, as I said before, is called Beyond Sustainability, an inspiring vision of the next 250 years. So if this is the beginning of the universe, and this is right now, and the last 10 years I blow out here, at that time scale, 14 million years equals 100 years, every minute on the cosmic century timeline is 250 years. I talk about this chart, but I go into a lot more detail. This is Ken Wilber's four-quadrant model. I spend about an hour on both of these charts, and this is one of the most inspiring, hopeful perspectives of understanding human evolution in the context of the evolution of life. In fact, this question that you were asking this gentleman here about why it is that I don't believe that everybody has to convert to this worldview, I cover that in depth on this program. And then finally, many people tell me that this is the most hopeful chart I've used in the last 6 years. How the mechanistic paradigm, that is the idea that the universe is like a complex clock, how it came into being in 1543, it went through four major phase changes before it became the dominant paradigm. And this nested creative, the sacred nested creative understanding, has been really going through the same basic process. And if this pattern repeats, which right now there seems to be every evidence that there will, in the next 40 to 60 years, we are likely to see the kind of major positive changes that we saw during this 40-year period. I believe that in the next 50 years, we will see a global democratic revolution, an environmental revolution, what I call a biomimicry revolution, where we mimic biology rather than mimicking machines, and our redesign of law, medicine, politics, economics, education, where we learn how life has evolved, and I say we, I don't mean all humans, but enough of the leadership learning this so that we can move into a just, healthy, sustainable life in the future. And then finally, I believe we see a worldwide spiritual revival as all the religious traditions awaken to their own depth of understanding as a result of not just tolerating an evolutionary and ecological worldview, but wholeheartedly embracing it. And yes, I do believe that in the next 50 years, the majority of Christians, the majority of Muslims, the majority of Buddhists, the majority of Hindus will have fully embraced an evolutionary worldview. And then finally, what can we expect in the next cosmic minute? This is all we're talking about, the next minute on the cosmic century timeline. What are the major challenges that we're going to have to deal with? Global warming, biodiversity, population, the growing gap between the rich and the poor, biocomputers. These are going to be challenges. We're going to have to deal with these. And then what are the things that we may or may not have to deal with? But by God, if we have to deal with any of these things, they're going to be enormous. They're going to be huge. This is the scary stuff. But I don't leave people here. We take a square look at the bad news, but we're not going to have, because we're not going to be, we're not going to be in have authentic hope if we're in denial. So I conclude with what are the long-term and the short-term positive trends that we can count on continuing? We can bank on these trends. And then what's the likely good news? I'm not talking about crossing our fingers and toes and saying, oh, please, 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 please. I'm saying, what's likely good news in the next 250 years? And I spent a half hour on these two charts here. This is a very hopeful perspective, a realistically hopeful perspective. All of that's on both of these DVDs. So that same program, The first 2 hours of this and the second 2 hours of this are the same program delivered to different audiences. What's unique to this one is where I spend a half hour on each of these four gifts. How this perspective, this evolutionary perspective, reconciles science and religion. How it transforms our view of chaos. How it broadens our circles of care, compassion, cooperation, commitment. And how it evokes inspiring, empowering visions of the future. What's unique to this one is where I get into all the Christian stuff and I say, what's the difference between flat earth understandings of these and evolutionary reinterpretations of these? For example, heaven and hell. From a flat earth understanding, heaven and hell are thought of as literal places that I'm going to go to, one or the other, when I die. Right? And it's abstracted from our this world experience. What's heaven like? What's hell like? Well, it's abstracted. You can't understand pearly gates unless you understand pearls and gates. From an evolutionary understanding, heaven and hell are eternally true. That is true for everybody everywhere. I don't have to merely wait to die to go to a place called hell. When I'm in a place of arrogance, self-righteousness, judgment, bitterness, hatred, violence, when I'm stuck in my addictions, when I'm out of integrity, I'm in hell now. And so are you. It's true for everybody. I don't have to merely wait to die to go to a place called heaven. When I'm in a place of deep integrity, Christ-like integrity, when I'm full of love and compassion, generosity, loving kindness, care, consideration, I'm in heaven now. And so are you. It's true for everybody. All these concepts can be understood in the same way. If you get one of these, it's $30, and if you get two or more, then $25 each. Please, if you get any of these, do feel free to make copies for others. And if you're totally broke, if you just don't have any money, you just lost your job or whatever, you know, or you're retired and you don't have any money, but you really want one of these, just pay whatever you can. We just want to get the word out. I was invited 8 months ago to the Library of Congress by these two gentlemen. Now, they invited me there because both of them are Nobel Prize winners. John Mather is NASA's chief scientist. He's the senior astrophysicist. He's the Nobel Prize winner in physics. And Craig Mello is the 2006 Nobel Prize winner in medicine and physiology. They both wrote generous endorsements, and they were doing a program together at the Library of Congress, which is why they invited me there. John Mather said, the universe took 13.7 billion years to produce this amazing book. I heartily recommend it. Folks, as an author, it doesn't get better than that. Craig Mello said, the science versus religion debate is over. A must read for all, including scientists. I don't know if this is going to get down Oprah or not, but I figure it can't hurt. You know when you go to a movie and you've seen like a movie trailer at the beginning before the feature film, there's a little trailer? We created an 80-second book trailer for my book I wanted to share with you. Issued next month by Viking Penguin, so they're no longer allowing me to offer the free PDF download. For the first 5 months, we had it for free. 4,000 people downloaded the book for free, in addition to about 12,000 buying the book. I'd like to close with a song, and as I said, I'll stick around and answer questions while I'm on with people all night long if you want, but I want to close with a song that in many ways encapsulates so much of what I've been trying to talk about. But he does so in a way that, as with any artist, pulls it together in a way that words merely can. It touches the heart in ways that words can. And once you get the song, which you will pretty quickly, please help me sing along.
Everything is whole. after we leave, I'm going to leave up on here, like if I were to die tonight, the resources that I would most recommend are these. I'll leave this up here in case you're interested. But I'd like to close with a quote. This quote is from Brian Swim. He's the physicist that I've quoted a few times already tonight. And this will give you a sense of why Connie and I live on the road, why for 6 years we've been essentially homeless, living out of the generosity of people who open up their homes to us, and why we anticipate probably living this way the rest of our lives. It goes like this. I am convinced that the story of the universe that's come out of 3 centuries of modern scientific work will be recognized as a supreme human achievement. The scientific enterprise is a central gift to humanity. I'm convinced, he says, that the story of the universe that's come out of 3 centuries of modern scientific work will be recognized as a supreme human achievement. The scientific enterprise is a central gift to humanity. For the first time in human history, we finally have a creation story that's not tied to one cultural tradition, nor to a political ideology, but instead gathers every human group into its meanings. We are in the midst of a revelatory experience of the universe that must be compared in its magnitude with those of the great religious revelations. And we need only wander about telling this great story to ignite a transformation of humanity. Connie and I take that last sentence very literally. Thank you.